Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee. We are clearly not in our studio right now. We're actually in Pacific Grove, California, and I have a special guest with me, Allison Tetrick. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing well. It's Sea Otter Week, so.
I know.
All the bikers are in town.
You're surrounded by bikes off camera right now. There are bikes everywhere, bike parts everywhere, bike bags, the whole thing. Thanks for coming on, first of all. This is cool. You are known as the Queen of Kanza. You have a ton of different accolades to your name. First thing I wanted to say that's interesting, I'll actually get into something on this soon, but so you started in tri. Well, actually, you went to college for tennis, right?
Yeah, I played tennis in college.
Okay, so what did you do as a teenager with athletics at all?
Well, I grew up on a cattle ranch, kind of in the middle of nowhere here on the Central Coast, actually, but a little south, so in Santa Barbara County, in a town called Los Alamos. Yeah. And so we were pretty far from town, so my parents weren't really keen on driving us to and from a bunch of organized sports. So grew up horseback riding, you know, playing catch with my dad in the yard and doing kind of just ranch cowgirl stuff.
So you're active, but not necessarily like any sort of aerobic endurance sort of like specific endeavors, right?
No, not really. But then when I got to high school, I started playing tennis and then got a full ride to play tennis in college. So went for tennis. Turns out tennis probably wasn't my sport of calling. I was okay, but
yeah. What moved you from tennis to, did you go straight to triathlon from tennis basically in terms of athletic pursuits?
No, when I graduated college, BS in biochemistry, I went to go work in a lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Okay.
And I still kind of had that competitive edge. My problem with tennis was I didn't play it long enough to ever go professional. So you kind of been starting a sport with an expiration date. You know, you have high school and then you have 4 years of college.
And then it's done.
And then, yeah, you can play club tennis or whatever, but there's no pinnacle goal. And I think I'm very goal-oriented. So when I went to Massachusetts, that's a huge endurance running culture, obviously, for the Boston Marathon. So I got into running, had this fantastic roommate. Her name is Io Wang, and she's actually a fellow Camelback athlete with me.
Oh, cool.
And so we're now best of friends. But she got me into running. So I kind of thought, oh, I'm really good at this running thing. I love it. Turns out like I might be a little big for like long distance running, like day in, day out. And I just like kind of got obsessive compulsive. And so my knees started going, you know, you start just getting aches and pains. And my grandfather, who recently passed away, had started bike racing at the age of 55-ish, retired contractor, army vet. And he was a runner too. And then he found bike racing following around a bunch of guys on group rides down in Southern California.
Yeah.
So he's just like, hey, Al, like, try out bike racing. And I'm like, bike racing is the dorkiest thing I've ever seen.
They wear Lycra. They have weird helmets.
Yeah. And it's like, not just Lycra. It's like brightly hued Lycra.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
And I'm running and I'm like, these guys like pass me when I'm on the paths. You know, I don't like these guys. So dorky. But I love to run. So I thought, fine. I'll try triathlon then because
that seems less dorky, especially because you were already a runner.
You can wear shorter shorts. You know, you can wear the sports bras. I was like, this is way better.
You don't have terrible tan lines.
Tan lines are better.
Yeah.
Problem is I didn't know how to swim. So I started racing triathlon, bought a bike on eBay, showed up, surprised my grandfather at his local time trial in Colorado. And I'm like, got a bike. And I've signed up for the Buffalo Springs 70.3.
Wow.
And he's like, do you know how to clip in yet? I'm like, nope. Got a bike.
That's awesome.
I took some swim classes at the YMCA, you know, and I showed up to Buffalo Springs Ironman and won my age group and got a slot to Kona.
Did you go to Kona?
I didn't. I turned it down and I got booed when I turned it down.
Really?
Yes. They were all, you know, this is when you wanted to, you know.
People had no clue that you were just like,
this was my first triathlon. I literally didn't know how to get out of my pedals.
Like I don't want to go to world champs. That's totally understandable.
I did go to Clearwater that year though. So I did do the 70.3 world championships that year. But it was a really fun sport to do. I mean, for someone that loves exercise, I thought it was really good for my body balance. I had a mantra that was like survive the swim, race the bike, and then just throw spaghetti on the wall for the run because who knows what's left.
Right.
So what happened is I set a lot of bike course records, but you're losing, you know, maybe 8 minutes in the swim or something.
Right, exactly.
But it's pretty easy to get back on a bike if you're fast. Yeah. But then the run, I'd be like, I'm cramping. I'm getting really tired. They're like, well, maybe if you didn't beat all the pros in the bike split.
Exactly. It's so funny. Like in triathlon every year, I feel like there's some athlete that's coming in with a cycling background who's just a particularly strong cyclist. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, like in triathlon, people fixate on the bike leg, I feel like, more than any other one. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it makes sense. And don't get me wrong, I love cycling too, but it's a common thing to see for a lot of people that are strong on the bike. They come in and they just light the bike up. But it's like, yeah, but who cares? You know what I mean? Like in the end, like triathlon is so much more. So what pushed you from triathlon to road?
Well, then you know how people always give advice for triathlon, which is probably why we're here.
Of course.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm like, I want to get faster.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they say, well, you need, you know, in running, you do fartlek work, you know, for some speed work.
Yeah.
And so this triathlete comes out to me, you need to get faster on the bike. You need to try some like fartleks for the bike, but that sign up for your local criterium, give it a shot.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, it's so scary. You know, I go, I don't even have a jersey with sleeves, you know, I'm borrowing things to wear.
Yeah, yeah.
And I go to the like local criterium and, you know, I win.
Nice.
And I win my next race and I win my next race. And
yeah.
I'm just like, I still love triathlon because I love to run. I still love to run.
Yeah.
And I got a call from USA Cycling and with an invite for a talent identification camp at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs.
Right.
They said, we'd like you to come to this camp. I was like, can I bring my running shoes and my like paddles?
Yeah.
They're like, there is an Olympic size pool at the Olympic Training Center. So yes, if you really want to swim, you can, but
yeah.
We really want to test you. And that same month I got an offer for a pro contract on Team TIPCO actually. And I literally said, well, I'm going to run after every stage. That lasts a couple months. And
yeah,
like,
for sure. Yeah.
They just said, hey, you know, maybe you should just focus on the bike.
Right.
You could go to the Olympics. You could do a lot of incredible things on the bike. You're an okay triathlete. And yeah, I raced a couple pro events, but they're like, you're really good on the bike. So
you triathletes make, you're mostly a cyclist now, but mm-hmm. like there's nothing triathletes. If you want to make a cyclist feel bad about themselves, just go running, do a brick workout after that race. Cause we're completely wrecked and all we're thinking of is recovery. And then when triathletes start running, it just,
I will
just
admit,
terrible.
I've been that person.
Yeah.
And that's so embarrassing now. I would do like the local criterium and then like put on my shoes and I'd have my bibs down and just go for a jog around the office park or wherever the heck we were.
Well, but it's good mind game. Cause mm-hmm. then every time you show up at the next race, I'm just like, yeah, that person's insane. Like they are so good. They are such an athlete. You know what I mean? So, I think it's a good tactic.
Yeah.
So one thing that you didn't mention there, I think, and I may have this wrong, but your grandpa had a lot of national championships.
Yeah, my grandpa had over 17 national 17. Championships.
And then that's from when he started later on in life?
It's masters racing, and the time trial was a specialty. You know, he's a very analytical person, so helped me a lot in my time trial pacing and racing.
That's crazy.
And several road races. So, yeah, I showed up to nationals. He was still winning national championships over the age of 80.
Holy cow.
Yeah, I showed up and I made these shirts that said Team Tetrick on them and stars. And
oh, that's cool.
I was his like one band cheering section and I'm cheering for him like, go Grampy, you know, yelling as loud as I can. And he's like acting like he doesn't know me, right?
Of course. Yeah,
yeah, he's like looking the other way and everyone's like, hey, Paul, your granddaughter is there. And he's like, who? They're like Team Tetrick. Has your name,
you
your
hide.
Photo, a sign.
Yeah.
He secretly, I think, really loved it. He was very proud of me. And it was fun to share my career as it blossomed and could call him after racing the Tour of Flanders or, you know, winning medal at Worlds and being able to share my career. And he just always kept going, Al, like you're doing something, you know, you're
That's
doing
so
something.
Cool.
So
what an amazing man to be getting a national championships like that. Because, you know, we were talking about it this morning when you get into like 45 plus racing and then be above that, it's like fitness is still very much a component.
Mm-hmm.
It always is. But a lot of it too is motivation and like what you can like continue to find for motivation after to keep racing after those years. Do you know what motivated him to keep doing that?
You know, he was such an incredible man. He was quiet and very humble. He said cycling taught him humility. You know, every day he woke up, he's like, there's always someone better than you. Even if you won the world championships the day before, you wake up and you went and did it again, somebody would probably beat you, you know? I mean, and that's life, right? And he said, you have an opportunity to get better at something and challenge yourself. So he was just motivated to be as healthy as he could be and be the best athlete he could be. And still at 80, he's going, I'm losing some leg strength, you know, how can I, you know, and I'm giving him, you know, tips to get strength. But, you know, at one point, you know, it's just how do you be the best person you are?
Yeah.
And challenge yourself to keep improving. And sometimes that's limit your losses. Honestly, you know, we get places in our career that maybe it's, you need more rest. Maybe you need more balance or family time.
Yeah.
But what motivated him, I just think he was a puzzle, you know, and he wanted to figure it out. And for me, it was very special because he's, you know, he's like kind of a John Wayne, but you know, he's not really a cuddly guy, right? You know, he was, he was a hard guy. And, like bikes to us became this language of love. And he maybe didn't say he loved me all the time, but you know, he learned to through like sharing his wisdom and having me be able to call him when I'm crying after a race and him going,
Yeah.
I understand. And having him tell me he understood. So it's like, as athletes, we go through all these ups and downs and how do you keep coming back from it? And I just think he loved to be outside, see the scenery and challenge himself. Like fitness is addicting too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Constant improvement. Good man. That's awesome. It's funny that we actually just talked about this last week on the podcast, but we talked about basically, and I can't remember the exact terms that Coach Chad was using because they were over my head, but we were basically talking about the fact that as muscles atrophy or as you train and then you build up more muscle fibers, then you basically have more cells and those cells have nuclei. But then as you atrophy, you quit training, you know, you end up losing a lot of that, even the muscle mass itself, right? But the nuclei, the cells actually remain. Mm-hmm. And then you can end up, you know, when you train, that's why things can come back quickly for a person that's done more. That's why pro athletes can pull on things forever. You know, they can, you're amazed that they can, even though they may look out of shape, that sort of a thing, they still have so much performance potential, right? Because they can get it back with a short amount of stuff. Kind of like putting a name to old man strength, so to speak, you know, that people talk about. But they also,
such a real thing, by the way.
Oh, totally is, right? But it's interesting because they say that, you know, a lot of that has to do with genetics, the genetic component, and seeing your grandfather do so well, that sort of a thing. He has a lot of grit, it sounds like. But then on top of that, you know, I'm sure that he was also genetically, you know, strong, or at least converted his genetics, so to speak, to that. I'm sure that benefited you. And they also say that when you're young like that, you can actually see that you have the most potential to be able to build up and store up those nuclei, so to speak. So then later on, you can, you know, have more. So it's like a key thing. So it's interesting that your grandfather is like such a successful cyclist in that regard. And then, you know, passing it on to you, how you just so quickly picked things up. You know, it's interesting.
I think, yeah, a lot of it's genetics. I mean, both of my parents are incredible athletes. My dad played football for UCLA. He's won the mountain bike race here at Sea Otter.
Oh, wow.
You know, when he picked that up later. But I had a team director once that I love the translation. So a Spanish team director.
Awesome.
Said, Allison, you know, you are very strong, but for you, it is the capacity of sufferance. And I think, though, too, with the, it's not just that old man strength where it's just about nuclei. I don't think either. But once you know that you can push yourself and you're not afraid of the pain or afraid of failure, or you don't care if you do and you have the capacity to suffer, or according to my director, capacity of sufferance.
Yes.
I think that goes to something too. It's mentally strong, you know, and if you've been there before and you know how to push through those barriers and believe in yourself, stay positive, or fuel yourself off of anger and self-remorse, whatever fuels you, but just pushing through what that is, I think helps too.
I'm sure you had a lot of that too, where, you know, where you grew up more rural, a lot of hard work, that sort of a stuff. That's just like, those are principles of the family, right? Like growing up and that sort of a thing.
Yeah. Don't complain, push through. Yeah. Where's the blood? Are you hurt?
Yeah, exactly. You know? Right. Yeah. Yeah. We could all do with more of that. So you have a background in molecular biology, a degree in that. You also in clinical psychology as well. So you have like this innate understanding, I'm sure, of the athlete that you are, from the physical side, from the psychological side, and then on the actual performance side of things too. I guess you had this career in road racing where you've had a ton of success. You had a big crash, and that big crash ended up giving you a traumatic brain injury, broken pelvis, I think, at the same time, which is brutal. And that kind of shifted things. Is that what pushed you away from road? Because you're known these days more for gravel racing, but what do you think, was that what pushed you? What actually ended up changing that?
I think the initial crash was really obviously very traumatic and life-altering. A traumatic brain injury, life flighted out, a lot of mental health things, and coming back not only from the physical damage, but mental, emotional, and just overall life upheaval.
Yeah.
But I was pretty motivated to come back to the road because I was really attached to it. And I think a lot of us as athletes do that. And I mean, we're not talking about what motivates you, and you think about that Ironman or that race or whatever you want to, you're pushing towards. And that's what motivates you day in, day out. So coming back to the road is what motivated me to come back. A couple more bad crashes in there. And I just realized my head is really susceptible. And I really didn't want to go back to that dark place that I was. So when I started lining up, I still raced for probably 6 years, 5 years after that crash. And I had some of my best results, you know, I mean, I was on the medal at the UCI World Champion, you know, on the podium for UCI World Championships. And like, I'm having these incredible results, but then I hit a point where maybe a little therapy helped in this, but you're going to the last corner of a race in Belgium with cobbles, and we call them the Belgian death cracks, or, you know, you're at the Tour of Flanders and you're like, I should be so stoked I'm here and it's awesome. But also I don't want to take risk anymore. Like, I don't want to fight for that position. And I had a sports psychologist actually ask me, well, if you choose your health over results, are you okay with that? I said 100%, like zero guilt now. She goes, okay. And I was like, I'm done. Like, I'm actually going to choose my health over hitting a light pole or just taking risk. Yeah. And I was looking around and I was still really strong and really loved the sport. I really freaking love to ride my bike.
Yeah.
And I love like riding hard and talking crap to my friends. I love riding my bike, but I wasn't necessarily getting the endorphins and all that adrenaline from fighting anymore. And I just thought, I want to find a new challenge. Like, I wasn't going to go to the Olympics, but I had done every race in the world I ever wanted to besides the Olympics. So Tour of Flanders, Qatar, won races in Argentina, won races in Belgium, all over the US. And I'm like, Pan American Games, you know, like, what else is there?
Yeah.
And I saw this gravel thing and I thought, now that looks like a new challenge.
Yeah.
Also a good story. And it looks like freaking fun.
Yeah. And it's getting away from the crazy dynamics of road racing that you face on the danger side of things too. That's a hard, you making that choice to prioritize health over that. That's, I feel like a stop that a lot of people don't take with their careers.
Yeah.
So that's just immense respect for doing that. Cause that's, it's got to be really hard. I mean, you have success. You can still be successful. You could have still continued to probably improve and
set, for sure.
And get even more results. So making that sort of a move takes a lot of character.
Yeah, and I think it's just something that we want to remember is always choose your health or family. You know, find that balance and make sure you're just healthy just in general. Maybe it's not about a brain injury, but maybe it's about mental health or relationship health and, you know, other things in your life, work. Maybe you need to put a little more time at work, you know? Yeah. But also another thing, I worked with a neuropsychologist at the time too. He said, you know, you need to choose. It's so, you're in a powerful position and you can choose what you do with this sport. It's your choice. Don't let somebody make that choice for you. Mm-hmm. So it was almost like, okay, this is my life. It really effed up my life.
Right.
You know, this sport, like, I hate it. I love it. And it screwed up my life, but I'm like addicted. I love it and I need it. And this is my bike family and it's everything I want, but don't let it have the reins of it. So like, I want to take the reins of my own career and choose what I want to do. And then like, not let the bike define you, you know, like all of us, we love to ride, run, swim, whatever, you know? And it's like, just remember, like, you are so much more than just this athlete. And that's also, I think, what my grandfather taught me. I mean, he wanted to be so much more than just a cyclist, and that was just one of his ways he could challenge himself. But to remember to find that balance, to find that motivation, because I think if you burn out that, I mean, then what is there?
Yeah, what else do you have?
Yeah.
Yeah. And for the majority of us that are like listening to this podcast, we aren't paid for our results.
Mm-hmm.
We don't, you know, we have something else going on, which, I mean, you've also, you know, you've made a point to mention the fact that you still maintain a career constantly and you're growing that, you know, just to not make yourself entirely dependent upon that. So for us, and if we find ourselves like as us average Joes in that sort of scenario, we can't put ourselves in the spot where we're going to compromise everything just for that. So
I got a little psychological there, but you know, I think it's important, you know, and I think it makes you a better athlete. I mean,
yeah,
and you may look back in your Ironman prep training, like, oh, I could have gotten that workout and skipped whatever baby shower of my friend. But you know, nowadays I'm like, I'm going to the baby shower. And if I skip the workout, it's not going to be in the world, but that comes with sports maturity too. And doing the correct training when it's appropriate.
I want to ask you something on the psychology side. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that in your studies going through that, I mean, you already had a degree in molecular biology. I'm sure you had some psych classes on the way to that, that sort of a thing. But what changed in your approach to racing or training, or what was the biggest change when you went through that educational process for, you know, clinical psychology as well?
Yeah, so I had been working in a molecular pharmacology lab actually for Amgen in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And, you know, so, and also
same
I was-
Same folks at Sponsor California.
Right? Exactly. Awesome. Cool. And I still work for Amgen, funny story.
Kudos to Amgen. That's
we
awesome.
We love Amgen.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me tell you more. But I think though, when I was talking about earlier about how we define ourselves, and I mean, and that's not a bad thing to define yourself at all sorts of things. Like I define myself as an athlete. I define myself as a cowgirl. You know, I mean, I have these things like a sister, a daughter, a friend, hopefully to somebody, maybe a teammate at one time. But I also, I think I'd always define myself as being smart and, you know, very capable, you know, being, I was like valedictorian. I was, you know, always getting A's, you know, I was just really smart. And then with the traumatic brain injury happened, my comeback from that, that took several years. It's actually a daily battle. I mean, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But, I couldn't read for a year.
Wow.
So, I mean, I could read a menu or a street sign, but I mean, I couldn't read long emails. I couldn't read a book. And I realized I had to go back to invest in myself. Like my parents kind of helped remind me like, hey, do you remember you used to read all the time? You used to be educated and want to learn. And now you're just want to ride your bike all the time.
Yeah.
And so I also had worked, like I mentioned earlier, with a neuropsychologist, and he really helped me recognize where my headspace was and also made me not feel crazy.
Yeah.
So I thought neuropsychology is fascinating and what happened to my brain in this crash. So I went to grad school. But that was hard because my learning process is a little different from my injuries. So I was really proud, and it was a very expensive, you know, point to prove to yourself. Right. I mean, some people buy cars or get their nails done, you know. I decided to go to grad school.
Yeah, exactly. So did you, I assume that that changed your approach to cycling in some respects. Like, I mean, most of us, we pick up like some book on sports psychology and it has a big change on how we ride after just reading one chapter. Mm-hmm. Did you find that you changed that approach to like training or racing in any specific way after understanding more about psychology in that regard? Like, was there one thing that you feel like, okay, I'm going to apply this and this is going to help with cycling?
Yeah, I actually learned a lot. You know, most of my papers and even my thesis was based a lot on sports psychology, even though I wanted to focus on neuropsychology.
Yeah.
But, you know, sports is something I just am so connected to, and I found it really interesting. But I think it was about finding confidence, you know, in yourself outside of those results and, you know, being able to separate your results on the finish line as versus your results as a human being.
Yeah.
And then also just looking for my path to recovery from the injury and being able to be more accepting of others dealing with mental health issues or that might have a genuine disorder, you know, and looking for that.
Yeah.
And I found accepting others was also about accepting myself, which is, I think just makes you more confident that's outside of the results. And that to me made me a better racer. I started winning more after grad school in a way because I almost didn't care if I lost, and I'm not diving a corner and taking risk, but I also was willing to help others, give younger up and coming riders advice, and also not have my entire self-worth and confidence based on getting dropped on a climb or your local group ride.
Right.
So then that made me almost a more fearless of a rider because I mean, what was there to lose? I'm not just a cyclist.
and the end result doesn't define you as a person. You know, you are the person, you can go for the result, you can get the result, sure, but it doesn't define you, right?
Yeah. And like what's going to happen. So it made me probably, I was always a very animated racer. Like, I don't know, I don't like sitting around. I also don't like drafting. So
There
you go. Know, I think it's cheating. I mean, come on, why would you draft?
So from triathlon, that makes sense, right?
I'm like, just ride your bike hard. Yeah. So though it made me, I think be more bold and like go hard. People be like, why would you go? That was way too early. I'm like, I went because you guys are riding too easy, and I also don't care, you know, in a way. Like, let's make this fun. Like, I want to go hard, like, all the time or in these races.
Do you think that played to your success, I guess, transitioning into gravel? Do you think that played into your success, that sort of, like, go-for-broke style attitude and I guess, tactical approach? Did that help you in gravel racing specifically?
Yeah, because as a road racer, for those that don't know, I was, like, probably defined as a time trialist. I've been a GC rider. I've been a domestique. You know, but I was a time trial specialist. Also, I'm a huge like science dork. So, I mean,
TTs.
I love to go to the wind tunnel. I like all the fast stuff. I want all the ceramic bearings. You know, I pimp out my bikes.
It's a shame our CEO, Nate Pearson, isn't here. He's about as analytical as it gets with that sort of stuff. So,
I crunch a lot of numbers, make my own spreadsheets, calculate everything. And TT is all about preparation that way.
Yeah.
But also, it's about pacing, which I know we'll talk about later, but it's pacing and kind of getting into that beautiful spot of suffer in your brain and like it. And I don't know, I just freaking love it. Like I love that dark place you go and that suffering aspect. And So if you go like as a time trialist, of course, you have to know how to suffer. And then domestique, you know, you ride all day and you still have to make time cut and you're riding as hard as you can. And then GC is a whole nother thing. And then going for broke, you know, I won most of my races solo because why ride with other people? So I, you know, and you're out there and you just like, I could go into this like very comfortable place of dying.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically. Have you found a pattern or anything that helps you get into that state? Of like you said, because it's like that suffering that you actually thrive off of in some respect. It's not the suffering that's really just like demotivating and dropping you, but you're in like that sweet spot with it. Have you found anything or do you do anything to try to get into there?
I think in some of my training, I mean, I used to say, you know, you have to train your weaknesses, obviously, but yeah. Train your strengths for sure, because you win races off of most likely your strengths. So I try to race my strengths, and if all else fails, you know, race your weaknesses, because here goes nothing.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But you know, one of my strengths being a time trialist, so I like a lot of those like high steady state, like right under your threshold. I think most people tend to go too hard on those. Like, yeah. I'm not going all out.
Yeah.
So if my time trial power is whatever, say it's 330 watts, like you're not ever training at 330, but maybe it's 300, you know? Yeah. And so you're never fighting the bike and you find this very zen moment of like getting comfortable, being uncomfortable.
Yes.
Yet you're not like rocking around, like fighting it.
Yeah.
And then I'm also not in that gray area that most people ride in, which is that really annoying gray area.
Yeah,
it's not a recovery ride.
Not your style.
It's not a recovery ride. It's not endurance pace. It's just this like really annoying gray area. I'm like, if you keep riding there, that's how fast you're always going to go.
Right, exactly. Let's talk Kanza specifically. Mm-hmm. And I guess that we'll talk Kanza, but I want to talk on the preparation side of mm-hmm. things. Did your training change dramatically when you went from road to gravel? Did you find yourself doing more of a specific type of effort? Or did you find yourself spending more time on flats, less time on climbs, even something as simple as that? How did it change?
It's funny because starting Dirty Kanza, I mean, I had never ridden over 120 miles and there I am lined up to a 206 mile race. So I've actually just kept my training about the same. I mean, yeah. I'm on my 10th year being a professional cyclist. So I've kept it just training for road. But, you know, what I'm missing, though, is doing all those races. So, you know, my highest, I race 96 times in a year. You know, it's the problem when you can do most things.
Yeah, yeah. You get raced a lot, right?
I get raced all the time, and I'm just so positive. so, you know, so I'm missing some of that race intensity now. So now I'm trying to pepper in maybe a little bit more intensity. But my training stayed relatively the same. You know, I do some of those VO2s in early season, switch to those high steady states. But what changed is I always do my group ride twice a week religiously if I'm home. Like, yeah. Love my group ride. I think that's really good for a little intensity.
That gives you some race pace. I assume like a spirited group ride.
Oh, it's so freaking fast.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So fast.
Yeah.
So I love though, you know, I love like, you know, 50 guys can show up on a Wednesday and I can go ride with them, get some leg speed. I can go really hard or I can sit in or, you know, make fun of their hair. I don't know. I can do whatever I feel like that day. Yeah. But what I changed more, it's funny, if you look at my training peaks or, you know, power database, whatever you use, I mean, I rode my bike more being retired or, you know,
pro road.
Like I'm not racing world tour races all over the world.
Yeah.
And I did, I think I did like 100 extra hours, you know.
Wow.
And like 4,000 extra miles. I mean, I did something like just crazy, like way more. And my coach is like, you ride your bike so much now.
Did you think you were enjoying it more?
I just liked it more.
Yeah.
Like I'm more into the, I'm not as tired because I'm not racing as much. So I don't have that like, oh, I need to recover. And now I'm just a little more keen to do those 100 mile days with my friends on the weekend that maybe involves Sancerre and oysters or, you know what I mean? Like something just kind of fun and it's an adventure.
Yeah.
But before, if you have a big crit you're doing the next day, you're like, oh, I can't, you know, it's going to make me slow. Now I'm like, screw it.
Yeah, go for it.
Where are you guys going? You're going to ride down here? Sure. Right. Why not?
Yeah. So if going into something like Kanza, you mentioned that you hadn't done a long ride like that. Mm-hmm. Going into the 200 miles, you didn't feel the pressure to need to replicate that, like do 200 miles beforehand, right?
No.
So that's like a common question that we get. People are like, should I basically just do the same race distance, whatever it is, you know, like that?
No, I think a problem a lot of cyclists and probably other athletes do is you constantly want to test yourself. And I really learned in my career not to. Like, it's a day before a time trial. I don't even do openers because it stresses me out. Like,
yeah.
Suddenly that I'm like, oh, this Watts is too hard. I think I'm, you know what I mean? And like,
right.
But if you constantly are testing yourself, that's all you can do and you can never do more. So, and I also think another big mistake that, not to label it, but masters racers make a lot because they love bikes. They love to watch the pros. They love to race, you know, ride the group ride of the pros or whatever.
Yeah.
They see the pros doing 25, 30 hours a week. So that's what they think they need to do.
Totally.
And I go, well, what's your longest race? And their national championship is 80K. I'm like, honestly, 80K is as long as you ever really had to ride if you want to. I mean, you could go and race a national championships on 10 hours a week. Like, you do not need 30 hours. Like, you can do this.
Yeah.
So for Cairns, I take a similar aspect. Like, I ride 200 miles. It was 206.
Yeah, last six
once a year. And believe me, I don't want to ride it anything longer. Gravel Worlds is 150. And there's a couple other ones that are maybe like Belgian Waffle I did, which is 137.
Yeah.
But those are the three longest rides of my entire year.
Yeah.
I do like maybe 100 miles every other week because I like it. I don't think I have to, honestly.
Right.
Because my 100 miles like aren't full gas hard. You know, like I said, there's wine or something.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
it's fun.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't have to be full gas all the time either. So it just matters of quality. Like, I have a lot of quantity riding my bike because I like it.
Yeah.
But if you're trying to like not get divorced or keep your job, I mean, it's quality over quantity and you don't need to test your legs. I think you could do Kansas probably with just 100 miles, honestly.
You made a lot of changes, I'm sure, on the equipment side coming into Kansas. You ride for Specialized. I assume you rode the Roubaix most recently there, or did you do the Diverge?
I did Diverge.
So the Diverge is like a bike that basically has like built-in compliance, so then it can go over bumps and that sort of stuff. Was that like a big departure for you, getting like that technical on the equipment side of things? I mean, you did TTs and triathlon, so you may have just felt like coming home. But
oh man, it was like when I got to work with Specialized for the last couple of years, I mean, it was a dream job. I'm just going to like pitch it a little bit. Like, it was like, it's like every athlete's dream. Like, I wish I could have raced the Shiv when I did time trials. Like, I am just like, the bikes are so fast and really a bunch of smart engineers out there constantly looking to innovate.
Yeah.
So, when I got to get all the Specialized stuff and it's a blast. So I rode the Diverge at Kansas. It has a Future Shock, is what it's called.
And that's
so it has
the head. That's the shock. Head, up it has
a
the shock
in the headset, and it's about 20 millimeters of travel.
Yeah.
I rode 38 millimeter tires, so the triggers.
Okay.
And
were those on like slightly wider rims? Do you think
I rode the Roval CLX 32s?
Okay. And are the triggers like a file tread pattern, or do they actually have tread on
them, tread.
Right?
Yeah, full tread. Yeah.
Do you think that's better at Kansas just because of the sharp rock?
You really want a tough sidewall for sure. I mean, you're turning a lot. Like in Kansas, you don't have, like people go, do you get bored? But your course isn't marked. So, I mean, I'm using a Lezyne GPS and it's like pointing out the course, but it's like usually like 1.4, take right, 1 point, you know, I mean, it's not like you're going these long stretches. And so those corners are loose too. So I like a little bit more tread for that.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to win the race in a corner at Kansas, but you could really lose your race. So
I feel like if people actually looked at the course of Kansas, they would realize how many turns it has. It has a ton of turns.
You turn all day.
Because it's just like on a grid pattern, right? And that makes sense because if every time you go through that turn, you carry X amount of stress.
Yeah.
And tension through your body, and you have to slow down this much, then you have to reaccelerate, that sort of a thing. It adds up when you have that many turns because you have a ton of them.
Yeah. And you want to pick the right lines. You just want to be safe too, like I said. And also I think it's about not bulldozing over some of these, they're called the Flint Hills for a reason. And, you know, they make like arrowheads out of those things. So, that's sharp rock. So yeah, I think you want a real tough sidewall. The trigger has been awesome. And I do the 38s. I feel super safe, on that.
So you run slightly lower pressure in that?
Yeah, about 40 and 40 and 38, 40 front, 38 rear.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So something pretty light. You can start out a little higher as it decreases through the day because you're on your bike a long time. But, you know, you don't want to burp a tire, but you want to feel comfortable.
Yeah.
I think that's what I have somebody else pump up my tires because it stresses me out.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I understand that.
I go, I rode 50 and they're like, you didn't ride 50. But as a roadie, like, when I first started racing road, like we were riding 100 tire pressure. Now I race 88.
It's crazy.
On the road.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, 88's good. And so when I'm racing cans, I'm like, I think I need to ride like 60. They're like, no, you need to race like 35. I'm like, no, just tell me it's 60. You know,
yeah,
so
yeah,
I just like,
tell me it's 60.
So I told somebody that, and it was in an article somewhere. And then I asked my mechanic at the race, and he's like, yeah, you rode 40.
Yeah. Like, oh, there you
thanks
go.
Thanks for telling me I was riding 50, because right. I was like, I'm going to be too slow.
Yeah, of course. It's crazy. Even on like my road bike that we're looking at over here in the corner, I have slightly wider rims on that, and I only run, I think I'm running like 60, I think oh. I'm 68 PSI. Oh, so pretty light. Yeah. Yeah. So what else did you do on the equipment side of things? Did you like double wrap your bars or anything
no,
like that? You don't really need that, I guess, since you have that shock.
I rode a normal kit. So bibs and jersey, specialized there. I think something I had that's really beneficial is I wear the Camelback Chase vest. They actually just recently came out with a women's specific fit as well for,
cool.
Which I think is super cool, because not men and women aren't technically built the same, especially in the chest area.
Yeah. That's something my wife's been looking for. That's awesome. That's good to know.
It's super rad, and they're coming really cool colors. But what's cool about the Chase Vest is a lot of people coming from road or triathlon background think Camelbacks are more for mountain biking. They're too heavy.
Yeah.
That's the feedback I got. But when you try the Chase Vest, it's short. You can still reach into your pockets. So okay. You can still have your rear
pockets.
In your jersey pockets.
Awesome.
And then it's 1.5 liter bladder. And then you can have your other snacks and emergency stuff in there, you know, in case all hell breaks loose.
It has like pockets on the front too,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then you can store like snacks or something.
Yeah, you can have snacks. And then it also has rear pockets like a jersey, as well as a protected zip pocket. And my trick for Kanza is, so for those that don't know, I mean, Kanza is not marked. So you're no course mark, no follow cars, no anything. Yeah. So you have to have a GPS that works. The Lazine GPS, I mean, 11.5 hours or 11 minutes, 11 hours, 40 minutes and 41 seconds for the record. And I still have 60% battery in your life. And people with other devices have to get external.
Oh yeah. Run battery packs.
60% battery life. I finished and the thing is $150 or something. I mean, it's not even expensive and it was awesome.
Cause you can't just follow the pack too. Cause you never know when somebody's going to take a wrong
turn. Yeah. And you're by yourself a lot.
Yeah.
So. Ideally, but
or not if you're off the back, but yeah.
But then the other trick was, so there's, well, the next year is a little different, but, or this year, I guess, but there's three, at this point, there was three specific aid stations. And so I had Camelbacks like already full of like everything identical. So I had three Chase Vests, which I know that's first world problems here.
Yeah,
so I have three identical Chase Vests waiting for me for my pit crew. So it was really fast. I just grabbed two bottles, lube the chain, like clean the cleats, maybe get the mud out that's like slowing
stuck
you down.
There.
And I mean, my pits were, speaking of triathlon, I mean, 45 seconds, I'm out.
It's basically like a transition for triathlon.
It is, but I just grab a new Chase vest. I'm like lifting up my foot. He's cleaning the cleats. He's lubing the chain. I'm like grabbing donuts and potato chips and I'm out, you know? So I think that's like kind of interesting to think about what you want in your aid station and then how to like, I mean, some people like don't race through maybe if you're not racing it.
Yeah.
But I'd recommend trying to get out of there relatively quickly so you don't like second guess yourself and what you're doing with your life.
Right?
No.
Like, yeah, because you stop 150 miles into that 206 mile ride and you're not going to be very keen on restarting, I'm sure.
No, I laughed because I mean, you're about, for me, I was about three-ish hours until the next aid station, you know, and I'm two bottles and then the Chase vest and I'm out every time.
Yeah.
But all I'm thinking about is seeing him, you know, I'm like, oh, he's going to be there. You know, he's going to be there. It's going to be great. I'm going to get some donuts and some animal cookies. It's going to be great. You know, and I get there and I'm like,
rip through it super quick. Yeah.
And then I'm like, okay, in another 50 miles, I get to see him again. It's going to be so great.
So one of the questions we had on that, because we got submitted, and this is through forum.trainroad.com, which you can, if you're watching this episode or listening to it right now, you can check it out. Mm-hmm. We'll have a thread on there. And I encourage you too, to jump in there too, because I'm sure people have questions.
Oh, yeah,
so
I'd love
it'll
to.
Be cool.
Yeah.
But one of the questions that we got was pacing on that.
Mm-hmm.
We did like a race analysis on Jeff Kabush's effort last year. We looked at his power profile with Trainer Road and checked all that stuff out. How do you pace it? Because here's the interesting deal. I think that it changes in some regards with females. Do they start you in separate waves as
no.
females? It's all
it's
mixed.
Mass start.
So since it's mass start and you're much faster than the majority of females, you find yourself, I'm sure, in co-ed groups, right? Is that, do you find that, how does that work? I'm sure, because a guy doesn't want to get, and I say this, you know, pointing out that it's a problem, but like a guy doesn't want to get, and I'm saying in quotes, chicked, right?
Yeah.
And I'm sure they aren't eager to work with you. Is that the case? Or do they just accept it and you follow in?
It depends what time in the race you're yeah. meeting such an individual.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is a podcast for another day. I mean, gravel's changing a lot. I mean, there's gravel teams out there. There's yeah. men and women teammates. I mean, it's getting a little dicey, let's just say. But, yeah, yeah. You know, each to their own. So it's, for me personally, I don't have any teammates. I'm just going out to race. So when I do not recommend necessarily my tactic because yeah. I don't always make the wisest choices. I'm trying to work on it, but I'm like, I'm going to go as hard as I can for 100 miles and I'm just going to see what's left. Like, this is back to my triathlon yeah. approach and hasn't changed much, right?
Right. Yeah,
so
yeah.
I like to stay though, the first year, the year I won, you know, I stayed with the front group of men for the first 100 miles. So, I mean, we did 100 miles on gravel in under 5 hours.
Wow.
And then I was by myself for a very long time.
Did you blow up after that? Was it too hard, the pace?
It was too that's hard like, for me to
that's,
sustain.
That's a fast group on the road.
Either. Yeah. Yeah. And now we're talking, you're on knobby tires.
And you're 40. On, yeah, that's a ton of rolling resistance. Just jack your wattage right up for everybody because yeah. it doesn't matter if you're drafting or not. You've got more rolling resistance. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had like maybe 12 minutes or something on second place at that point, which I like in the next 80 miles lost because I was totally solo. Yeah. You know, I'm hallucinating. I'm seeing palm trees.
Sure.
I'm seeing yeah. stormtroopers.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like convinced she is a stormtrooper.
Like, yeah, yeah.
I'm yeah. like, are there jets? Are we in Star Wars? I take yeah. a couple wrong turns. I'm, you know, so that I didn't probably pace it that well. I mean, I think there is something to having a set wattage and setting that pace.
Yeah.
However, what worries me about that is something that, you know, hopefully don't worry about that in triathlon and the longer distance courses. But with the drafting, you know, sometimes I kind of throw the dice. I mean, I might change that approach if somebody tries to talk me off my ledge, but I kind of like to roll the dice. Yeah. I hate getting dropped, you know, and I like to be in the mix.
For sure.
And I just don't want to miss that free ride with a bunch of really strong dudes, you know, like,
yeah,
I'm like really nervous about that yet. I'm not sure that's the smartest decision. Like I said, I've been trying to like somebody's analyze it, just hold this watts, you know, and do the whole thing. I'm like, to me, that sounded boring. And also sure. I was like, but they're all going to leave me and who am I going to talk to? And
yeah, exactly. Who are you going to heckle?
Yeah. Like, who am I going to sing to out here in yeah. the middle of nowhere? So I think though, for somebody that's not racing at tri would be in the front group. I think though, what's really important with Kanza is to not go too hard at the beginning, which we all want to do because mm. everyone feels like $1 million. And I used to call this in time trial. I'd call it time trial heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
And for the first 4 or 5 minutes of a time trial, everyone's like, you're not going to lose any time because guaranteed no. everyone is going the same pace.
Oh, yeah.
Now it's just a matter of who can sustain that pace.
Yep.
So Kanza heaven is probably much longer. Maybe it's like 20 miles or something. And
yeah.
I mean, guys are passing me and I'm like, I am going to finish 6 hours in front of you. Like, exactly. And you are going to like elbow me to like,
yeah, exactly. Make you fight for the position to get by.
Yeah. And I'm like, yeah. you're going to blow up, man. So I think though, a lot of people go too hard at the start. Cause they feel great. Yeah. They're excited. You're starting totally. With 2000 people.
Sure.
There's 20,000 fans on the side of the road when you start. I mean, it's really amazing experience.
Yeah.
And everyone's just so amped. So I would recommend somebody that's going for goal time of whatever that is. It's not trying to make the Ted King group.
Yeah, yeah.
To go
leave Ted.
Yeah, just like chill out for a sec, and then like you'll have a good pack. There's a lot of people, 2,000, and then if you blow up in the first 30 miles, it is a really long day. I can tell you that from personal experience.
Oh, it'd be brutal in that wind and with everything else. What other mistakes do people make when they go to Kanza outside of like the pacing side of things, or maybe it's something else with pacing, but. What are the common mistakes that you feel like you wish you could tell people when they go to Kanza? Like one that you see pretty regularly. Maybe
definitely,
nutrition, equipment, could be anything.
Definitely the pacing for sure.
Yeah.
Just because, yeah, I mean, that's just our typical self.
It's tough to pace a 10K time trial, let alone a 200 mile race.
And you're overthinking it too. I mean, you've read all the blogs, you've listened to this podcast, you know, you're trying to figure out the tricks. And I think like a big mistake, it's, you know, preparation for something like that. That's probably why I like it. It takes yeah. a long time, like months, oh, yeah. months.
Yep.
I mean, your bike, your equipment, your hydration, who you want in your feed zone, or neutral, whatever, you know, and your nutrition. But you know, I think though you have to prepare, like expect the best, prepare for the worst type thing. Yeah. So with like in my nutrition, I have everything under the sun. You know, I'm like, what am I going to want? A salami sandwich? Am I going to want potato chips, frosted animal cookies, donuts, a beer, bourbon, goo, you know, everything, you know, I just I mean, I didn't never have used the alcohol, but I thought if I have a really bad day, you know, I don't know. I just might
just
need
in case
I just might need to relax for a second.
Yeah.
Take myself less seriously. So I think, though, they get people just amp themselves up and they get so nervous, and it's just about preparing, like making lists and starting. If you're doing Kansas, it's pretty soon. Well, I should start preparing more. I have people for that, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to start making these lists and preparing. And then Celine Yeager, who's a editor at Bicycling Magazine.
Of course. She's awesome.
I love her.
Yeah, yeah. Fantastic content.
And so she gave me a quote. I did a forum the day before Kansas, and she gave me a quote, and I've used it in life and relationships since then. But for Kansas, I think it's really important is like forward progress, take care of yourself.
Yeah.
Because in something that's that long, it's say it's at least for most of us 11 and a half, 12 hours, you know, and now you're looking at 14, 18 hour finishers. Like, so what you want to make sure you do is like checking in with yourself. Like, am I pedaling my bicycle? Is it moving forward? Check. Okay.
Yeah.
But then am I taking care of myself? Am I eating and drinking? And even when I feel horrible, and then I think more importantly, even when I feel really good at the beginning and it's colder and, you know, so it's just about that kind of preparation. And then when you hit that dark place, like I used to use this in time trialing as well. And Kristen Armstrong gave me this advice, but you know, everyone's going to lose focus. So in Kansas case, it's not a time trial. So it's more focus could be used. You're going to get low. You're going to be defeated. You're going to be questioning why you broke up with that guy 6 years ago because you have nothing else to think about.
Anything creeps up.
All the demons are going to come out. And,
totally.
And then you're going to beat yourself up over it because you're like, I prepared all this time. I've spent all this money. Here I am, and now I'm having a day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we feel that. Yeah.
And but then like regroup, you know, like forward progress, take care of yourself. You are strong, you're capable. Also, I remind myself, Allison, you like chose to do this, right? Like you could have slept in.
Yeah, yeah.
You bought your ticket, you flew out here, you signed up for this, you've worked, you know, 6, 8, 10 months for this event.
Yeah.
Like actually no one forced you by like chain to come up here, you know? Yeah. Like so choose it and own your life choices.
Yeah.
Which get debatable in those moments.
My wife always says, remember why you started, right?
Like, yeah.
Like think back to that. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's a good one. Yeah.
So I think though people just go mental more than like, I mean, physical, totally. But then once your mind goes, you start questioning your physical, and then sometimes your physical just goes along with it. I mean,
yeah.
Last year I started cramping on mile 60. That's a problem. Yeah. I was like, oh, we've got a long day ahead of us.
How'd you deal with that?
I have a thing to get out of cramping.
Okay. We're all ears.
I don't want to exhibit it. It's a little embarrassing, but, but I do like these big yellow, like big belly breaths, like yoga, like,
yeah, yeah.
And I feel like if you can like relax and I do really loud, like full yoga, like I don't even take
like
yoga.
Doing like ohms and stuff like that.
I don't take yoga by the
way. Yeah,
but I'm just talking like those big, like
big belly breaths,
you know, and you're like breathing out where your like cheeks are jiggling. It's like not attractive at all.
Sure.
But I feel like what that does is like it automatically, if you try to do it right now, it automatically causes your hands to feel looser. Your toes like stop clenching.
Yeah.
So I feel like it tricks your body that it's relaxed.
I think it does actually. I think it's proven to relax your central nervous system, right?
Like, right.
I think,
it like, is proven, like across, deep breaths. But yeah. I'm talking these are really ugly deep breaths because I'm really like trying
ugly
to do
crying,
it.
But ugly deep breathing.
But you also have like blood lactate, you know, building in your in your stuff. And so if you think about the buffer process of buffering blood lactate, which is what we happens, right? So you have this buffering process, and that byproduct is CO2. So I also feel like I am expelling a lot of CO2. So I check in and I just find like my body relaxes because our initial response when you start cramping is to panic. Like you're like, crap, I'm cramping. My life's over. I'm going to be on the side of the road. You see that dead snake. You're like, that is me.
Yeah.
I am not finishing this.
You're never on higher alert than when you're in danger of cramping and you're waiting for that muscle to grab.
Yeah.
Like you're never on higher alert. I swear, you know, like you're just locked up basically before locking up.
So I try the big belly breaths and I check in like, and I feel like it makes you, I call it piano fingers, but you know, then you start cramping. You want a white knuckle.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, ah, I'm going to cramp, which then of course makes like your forearms, which you're not even using, start cramping.
Everything. Yeah,
I have like full body cramps there too. My hands have cramped. You know, I mean, it's not pretty. Yeah, but I think though, try the big belly breaths. They're ugly.
Huh.
Do them alone if possible. But they help, and I just think it tricks it, and then you can kind of get that happy Zen place for a second. And then you're still gonna be on that verge, but chug a bunch of water. I do the electrolytes.
There's so many things that could cause cramps, right?
That like, no one knows, right?
No one really knows.
Basically, for me, that's all I know.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm tired.
When you're pushing things further than they should be pushed, things like that happen, right? But yeah, that makes sense though, because the central nervous system, one would think, definitely plays a role in that sort of a deal. So,
and I think a lot of people want to stop or they want to get off their bike. I'm always like, unless you have to, just try to keep moving really lightly. Like I feel like as soon as somebody gets off, it's bad news. So when it happened to me at Kansas this year, the guy I was riding with, he's like, just keep pedaling. And I'm like doing these breaths. I mean, snot's going everywhere. Like, but I mean, I think pedaling like through it and keeping your toes light, your hands light, and those breaths just like relax you. And then maybe you can stave it off for a bit. You still might end up cramping, but I think it's just no panic.
My toddler remembers that all the time with finding Nemo, finding Dory. Just keep pedaling.
That's what I say.
Just keep pedaling. Exactly.
That's in my head. And it is finding Nemo, Dory's voice. But I say just keep pedaling.
Yeah, it works great. Yeah, that's fantastic. So I guess outside of Kanza, I'm going to run into some, because we're just going to run through some questions that people have submitted here. This is through the forum. One person was asking about Gravel Worlds. That happens in Lincoln, Nebraska, right? Mm-hmm. Any specific advice you could give somebody on Gravel Worlds or specific takeaways that you feel like would be very valuable for somebody on that? Or
easy? So Gravel Worlds is interesting, which is cool about gravel is no one gravel race is the same, you know, mm-hmm. obviously. I mean, I'm just talking about all the gravel's different,
like surface.
What someone calls the gravel road could just be a dirt road, you know, Kansas flint rock, and Lincoln, Nebraska is very interesting. It's gravel are these like really pretty, almost like aquarium small pebbles that are just, like smooth.
Huh.
You can walk barefoot on it and like you feel like you're on a Hawaiian beach. It's strange. Like they're very pretty polished little stones. So they're loose. That's one weird thing about them though too. Like the road looks really smooth, but you don't know where it's going to be deeper and your wheels might, you know, give you a little rodeo there for a sec. So, but since Gravel Worlds is 150 miles, about the same elevation gain at Kanza. So it's still about 10,000, 11,000 feet in 150.
Yeah. So it's more gain per distance.
More gain per distance. But I never was alone at Gravel World. So Kanza, I ended up alone. I think the rolling resistance is a lot higher at Kanza.
Okay.
So Gravel Worlds, I do think it's a good key is to be in a group. I think it's important for a while. Maybe you're coming into the finish and you don't want to hold that wheel anymore. Right. Or you want to attack to win or win your age group or whatever. But I think a pack is pretty important. And then also looking at how they do their aid stations, because you don't have your own support team there. You have to do only neutral.
Okay.
So the first year I did it, I had my Camelback, but you know, I'm just used to drinking out of that first. But then like, you don't want to refilling your Camelback. It takes just a second, but people are racing through these aid stations. They're like filling up bottles. And so I'm saying you want that group.
Yeah.
So the trick I had is this year, last year, again, I did a Camelback, but I didn't drink it until I needed to later. Like I saved it because I didn't want to have to refill it. And so I'm refilling my bottles instead.
Huh. There we go. That's smart.
Yeah.
And you always have that on you.
I had it on me the whole race.
It's insulated, I assume.
Uh-huh.
So then that's probably going to stay cooler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another thing I've done is they have bladders that can go in those front pockets of that chase vest and I freeze them. And so it's like a little ice vest.
That's clever.
Yeah. And then you have also extra 16 ounces of water on your chest that you can pull out and just suck on or whatever. But yeah, but then it's also like cool. So I do like cans as well with that. So I think Gravel Worlds, it's harder than you think. Like it is a lot of elevation and all of these climbs like are never over 2 minutes. Like they're very undulating, but you're just never flat.
Yeah.
So I think for them, that one is the group dynamic is a little different. And I think staying in a group is beneficial.
Yeah.
And just checking out the course. I mean, you can run a little more of aggressive bike at Gravel World.
More
just,
roadish oriented.
Yeah. You can do a little more roadish because you're not like riding on those flint rocks that can just like slash everything up. But I run the same exact setup, by the way, because it hasn't let me down yet.
You never know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just like feeling comfortable and I really don't want to flat. So I really trust my tires. I trust my bike. You know, I trust my equipment. And so for me, I keep that the same, but I do change my dynamic a bit.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm going to go into a couple other questions outside of that one. This one actually, so we're going to touch on the motivation one. Mm-hmm. This one right here. This one's from Sherry. She says, there's an ongoing thread on the Trainer Road Forum about women's training, menstrual cycles, how our physiology differs from men and related matters. I'd love to hear the input of Allison on this. This is a topic that we discussed with Amber Pierce on a previous podcast. Mm-hmm. I don't make a habit of advising anybody on this because I am, in fact, a man. So I don't have personal experience with this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a key thing because, you know, we talk all the time about managing stress, all sources of stress in your life, and making sure you're getting enough sleep, making sure you're offsetting that, making sure you're getting a proper diet, all those things to make sure that you have, you know, balanced hormones, that sort of thing. Whereas, you know, women are dealing with a natural cycle where that changes and it changes dramatically and it affects your training much more so than it does for us. How is that something, or how have you managed that through your training and racing?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a factor. And I mean, it's something that we can't really You can't change.
Right.
So unfortunately, sometimes I wish I didn't know what I know or know how my body is, because you feel your body doing something in some part of the month and you look at when the race is, you're like, crap.
Of course. It happens, right?
So what I would suggest though for women, first of all, is whether or not you want to share it with your coach or not. For me, I did, but I think just for all of us, you just track when you have your period. Like, mm-hmm. I guess that's not that obvious, but I did like a red dot on my like handwritten calendar, because I just wanted to know like what my, like how far apart was it and how regular. Is it 3.5 weeks? Is it four? Is it 4.5 and two right. some? Like for us, like especially when you're pushing yourself to this limit, you're probably pretty lean, maybe lower body fat. So, you know, it could be a little more irregular, but we really want to have that, of course, to be healthy. And that's sure. important for our bones and then overall just female health. So you'd like to try to have that. So what I did for a long time is just track when it was, so I could know roughly, you know, what's the separation. And then my coach actually helped me with this, but I found it very interesting, is I would put it in my workout program, and yeah. and I would say, oh, by the way, I'm on my period now, yeah. you know, and now I'm off. And I'd put it in there. But we ended up looking on how that affected my power.
Interesting.
And so when you're actually like menstruating, you might not feel good. And it's just obviously add some other like complications, because you're dealing with just the whole sure. like thing that's going on. You actually can do it. Like, you might be a little heavier, maybe a little water weight. Mentally, yeah. you're just bummed because it's annoying.
You're distracted from the discomfort to everything else.
Yeah, yeah, but you can actually, my power's fine. So like I'm not limited then. It's the week before, the actual PMSing part.
And that's where your premenstrual
power was lower. Huh. And I would have a week and I'm like, I just feel horrible. I hate my bike. Like I'm supposed to go and do this at 300 watts and I yeah. can't break 280.
Yeah.
And my coach is like, would be like, well, of course not. Look what week it is. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know why I feel like fat, slow and ugly, you know? And
sure. sure. Right. Yeah, yeah.
Also though, there was, besides like, of course, how our bodies feel, the puff and everything that can happen. Yeah. There was, I did notice like a flatter power output.
Okay. Interesting. So like less ability to be able to go like really hard, short effort.
My threshold was a little lower. Not, you can still win a race. I've won a lot of races PMSing, but
sure.
A, it really doesn't feel good, but I did notice physiologically it's just a little lower.
Interesting.
So how you approach that, I think though, is give yourself a little grace during that time. I mean, we're all going through it. But also I think just to understand and learn about you, mm-hmm. or the woman, you know, like know your body, because your body might not be like my body, it might not be like her, you know.
Totally.
I mean,
it's individual.
Individual. And then, I mean, my coach told me this once. I work with Carmichael Training Systems, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
They're amazing.
Yeah.
But he told me, like, just because it doesn't feel good doesn't mean you can't do it.
Right. Yeah, of course. Yeah. That's the truth. When is a race winning effort ever felt good? You know yeah. what I mean? Like, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. But I do think it's really, I just highly suggest like researching your body more and figuring out what's with you. And then also in that time, if it is like me and it's the week before you're actually like full blown on your period, you know, like watch what that does to your power and that. And then also just kind of do your training, like workouts appropriately. Like maybe if possible, that's your rest week. And then the next week you're sure. you're full tilt.
Kind of scoot it around. You can yeah. like with Trainer Road, you can drag and drop that week. Basically, you can just like push it back up in the plan, bring the other one down. It's pretty
yeah,
easy.
Yeah, just like you yeah. would. Yeah, I think that'd be really great to be able to move your workouts accordingly, just like yeah. you would for weather and also for your body, stress, sleep, red eye flights in and all of that. But having a calendar to be able to move around would be super beneficial for that. And then also yeah. just knowing your body and when you're going to be doing what. And that is something where I talked about earlier about what I've done differently since I'm not road racing.
Yeah.
Is I definitely do my long rides based on weather. Like road racing, I'm like, oh, it's a long ride. You know, it's pissing down rain. Like now I'm like, nope,
yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to switch that.
Don't need to do
so
that.
So think about it similarly. Like yeah. if you're having this, like look at the weather, and you can also look at your hormones and figure out how to adjust your training accordingly. And your yeah. own personal body is, I think, really important. So it's about that self-awareness.
Yeah. Yeah. Certain things you should push through, certain things you can get further ahead by knowing when to push through and when not to push
yeah.
through. Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So this one is, this is from Run Ride Randy. It says, read your article in Bicycling Magazine. She mentions, very inspiring. She says, I understand your crashes moved you away from road racing. And we kind of talked about this, but what drew you to gravel, dirt, and the long distance stuff? And the long distance part is what I want to focus on. You mentioned that you were a time trialist, steady state efforts, that sort of stuff. But like, did you know going into Kanza the first time that like I'm really good at really long efforts?
No, I had no idea. The long distance to me was just intriguing. Like yeah. we covered, I love to ride my bike. Obviously, it makes me very excited.
Of course,
I love to ride my bike, and I wanted a new challenge, and yeah. I wanted to see like what I could do because I felt no, I wasn't at my limit at road racing. I could have gotten better. I could have made some changes. Maybe drink less wine or something. You know,
sure,
probably a lot of things.
but I think we can all say that, right?
Yeah. But I there's new limits to my body that I wanted to. To go figure out. I wanted to go like crash through some like walls, you know, and yeah. see what I could do. And so longer distance was super intriguing. And just to see what I could, yeah, like a new challenge and a new barrier to break through. Cause I know I'm not at my limit of athletic potential. I know I haven't reached my peak at all as an athlete or a human. Yeah. So this was just a new challenge and a new venue of the sport. And also the people are just really fun out there.
Yeah.
You know, they're,
yeah,
they're always like pizza and beers and, yeah. you know, it's like a part of a story and an adventure. And I love riding my bike all day and having an adventure. So I wanted to see like how fast and hard I could do that.
Yeah.
And also, it's interesting, but women tend to be really good at long distance stuff. And that's when that gender gap starts getting a little closer.
Smaller.
Yeah, you look yeah. at my time in Kansas. I mean, I finished top 10 overall, and that's including men and women.
That's crazy. That's so impressive.
I mean, that's not so bad.
Oh, it's really good. Yeah. that's really good. Yeah.
So that's kind of cool. Like for women out there, like, I mean, I know we don't have time and the luxury to do it, but it's yeah. something that like we're really capable of. I mean, we just talked about the menstrual cycle, so we know we can handle pain.
Oh yeah.
Don't get me like why we even have that. There's a lot of pain involved there. I don't know from a personal standpoint,
right.
but that sounds, you know, it's yep. hard stuff. And so we have a high pain tolerance and you can really push through on these longer endurance stuff.
Yeah.
And it's a fun challenge. You know, if you're looking for a new, like we're talking about finding that motivation, you know, it's about finding goals that inspire you. And that one has inspired me so far.
So what I guess drives you next, this is kind of like what I guess we'll end on here. You know, you've gone into gravel, you've done extremely well there. What's the next motivation? What keeps you motivated now? What are you looking forward to?
Oh, I'm definitely looking through all of this and finding that next adventure. What's motivating me now is less of the racing, you know, aspect. Is it's what's motivating me now more is the adventure, maybe finding some more longer distance events I haven't done, testing equipment, I've done some really cool product development stuff with Specialized. We launched that saddle this year.
Yeah, yeah.
That is awesome.
The yeah.
power saddle with Mimic. Yeah. Super cool to like work with an awesome company and develop things for women cycling. Yeah. That's really motivating for me,
right.
giving our sport a voice. So on the bike, I think I did this really crazy bike packing trip in Kyrgyzstan last year with Specialized in Cycling Tips.
I was going to say if bike packing is something. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So we spent mm-hmm. 2 weeks in Kyrgyzstan. I've never camped in my life I had to let go. Like you can tell I'm like maybe a little type A and a little like have a little control issue. So for me, like going camping was terrifying. And also like I'm not training. I'm just with a bunch of people I don't know. And we're going to ride on the most beautiful place I've ever been in the world. But to let go of the reins like we were talking about
yeah.
this way in a good way, but like let go of that control and just be and enjoy the bike for the beauty it is.
Yeah.
That's super inspiring to me. So I'm going to go to Iceland this year, do a race there.
Oh, sweet. I think maybe even Pete Morris, our product manager, may be coming to that too. Hopefully he does.
Yes,
that'd be good.
The Rift.
Yeah.
You know, so looking for really cool, any new events or challenges too, maybe some more long distance stuff, maybe setting records or something I can still geek out about. But
yeah.
also just like being able to express myself on the bicycle. And I think to so many of us and me included, it ruined my life, saved my life, and it provides me with an incredible family, just this bike family that we get to understand each other, a bunch of crazy people that understand each other.
Yeah.
And it's just provided me a way to express myself and be me. So more ways I can do that, meet new people and experience new things and challenge myself and hopefully make the world a better place on a bike.
I'm excited to see what that is. That'll be cool. Thanks for joining us.
That'll
be cool. Where can people find out more about, actually, first of all, who are the companies that support you? We know Specialized.
Yeah. I am a big fan of Specialized. I work with Goo Energy Labs.
Goo.
Ride 100% glasses.
Awesome.
100%. I ride SRAM.
SRAM.
Speedplay pedals are amazing.
Cool.
Yeah. And Camelback, of course, and Lazine.
I'm a Speedplay guy. Yeah. That's awesome. And okay. Camelback and Lazine. So the reason I say that is because these are companies that support racing.
Pete's Coffee. Pete's Coffee is a good one. Ooh, drink Pete's Coffee.
Awesome. Yeah. So support those companies that support cycling.
It
all makes sense. So where can people find out more about you, follow along, everything you do?
You can follow me on Instagram or Twitter, Facebook. Facebook. I'm at amtetric, so A-M-T-E-T-R-I-C-K.
Awesome. Thanks, Allie. Appreciate this.
Thanks for having me.
Of course.